Kevin Barrett, thank you, author and Middle East expert from Madison. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءٍ ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: large-scale drone drills get underway across Iran, featuring scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat UAVs. United Nations says fighting must immediately stop around Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear plant to avoid a disaster. And also ahead, a former Twitter employee accuses the tech company of operating under poor privacy and security practices. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Iran has launched a large-scale nationwide drill involving dozens of drones and personnel from four branches of the military. The maneuver will cover strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman in the south to the eastern, western, northern, and central parts of the country. Ground, maritime, and air forces are taking part in the first-ever combined drill. More than 150 drones, including some jointly produced by the Defense Ministry and knowledge-based companies, will be put to the test for their control systems and combat capabilities. Earlier, defense officials said some other unmanned aerial vehicles used for reconnaissance missions will also take part in the maneuver. Iran has repeatedly said that its drills aim to boost the country's deterrent capacity. Iran's foreign minister says the country has preserved its political independence and succeeded in making economic and scientific progress despite the brutal sanctions. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a meeting with Assima Goïta, the head of Mali's transitional government in Bamako. He said Iran is determined to develop defense, economic, trade, scientific, and technological cooperation with Mali. Goïta, for his part, welcomed the expansion of bilateral ties. He praised Iran's achievements in the face of sanctions and its important status in global political and economic developments. He said people in Mali regard Iran as a role model and keep up their struggle against the excessive demands of foreign countries. Well, the Iranian foreign minister also says the interference by foreign states in the affairs of West Asian and African countries is the reason behind the emergence of some terrorist groups in these regions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also censured the West for using terrorism as a tool to serve its own interests. The top Iranian diplomat made the remarks in a joint presser with his Malian counterparts in Bamako. He noted that Iran supports dialogue rather than sanctions to resolve problems in African countries. He said Washington's, quote, cruel sanctions against Iran have proved that the West's use of sanctions is a failed policy. The Malian foreign minister, for his part, denounced sanctions and called them destructive measures. Abdoulaye Diop said his country is also against foreign interference in the affairs of the regional countries. Amir Abdoulayehan arrived in Mali on Tuesday on the first leg of his Africa tour, which will also take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar.
Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in the Malian capital Bamako on the first leg of his African tour, which will later take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar. Amir Abdollahian is heading a high-ranking political and economic delegation. A group of representatives of several private sector companies also accompanies him during his visit. The top diplomat was welcomed by his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop. Upon arrival at Bamako's international airport, the Malian foreign minister called the visit a sign of Iran's will to enhance ties with the African country. Amir Abdollahian confirmed that Tehran seeks all-out expansion of relations with Mali and has special plans for this purpose.
I am confident that we will start a new chapter of relations between Tehran and Mali under the government of President Raisi.
The visit is part of a wider policy roadmap in Iran. The foreign ministry says Tehran is looking to expand ties with African nations, including Mali, in the fields of economy, banking, and trade.
The United Nations urges parties to the Ukrainian conflict to immediately allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. During a Security Council meeting, the UN Undersecretary for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs said an urgent agreement is needed to reestablish the plant as a purely civilian infrastructure. The U.S. envoy called on Russia to immediately follow the UN recommendation and establish a demilitarized zone in the area surrounding the plant, which is in the control of Russian forces. Russia's envoy to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, said the IAEA mission to the site will take place in the very near future. He added that Moscow is ready to extend maximum support possible to resolve all organizational issues.
At the last meeting, not a single Western delegation had the courage to condemn the shelling of the station by the Ukrainian armed forces and ask the regime to stop it. We are under the impression that our colleagues exist in their own parallel reality in which the Russian military are themselves shelling the station that they are protecting and are using the American systems for that.
Russia and Ukraine have repeatedly accused each other of shelling the Zaporizhzhia facility. The plan remains close to the front lines, and attacks are raising fears of a nuclear disaster. The United States has announced a new batch of military aid to Ukraine worth about $3 billion. This as Russia keeps warning about the consequences of weapons supply to Kiev. U.S. officials say the package is expected to be announced on Wednesday, which is the day the war in Ukraine hits the six-month mark and the country celebrates its Independence Day. This will be the single largest aid package to be received by Kiev since the war began on February the 24th. It will bring to nearly $14 billion the total amount of military assistance the Pentagon has offered ever since. Germany has also pledged a further $500 million military aid for Ukraine. Berlin's package will be delivered next year. It includes anti-aircraft systems, military vehicles, and rocket launchers. Russian officials say such shipments only add fuel to the fire of war and prolong the conflict. We're now joined by former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett, who's with us from San Francisco. Mr. Bennett, it's great to have you with us. Ukraine is accusing Russia of using the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant as a cover to launch attacks, and Moscow is accusing Ukrainian forces of shelling areas around the plant. How risky is the situation surrounding Zaporizhzhia right now?
Well, it really is quite alarming that you're hearing this kind of rhetoric. You're seeing this kind of clown-like puppet show among hysterical, quite possibly people have gone really crazy. I mean, Zelensky and his Ukrainian hoods who are at the UN and their delusional propaganda about counteroffensives and being able to fight back against Russia and killing Russians everywhere they find them, including women and children and old people. This is truly the sign of a lunatic fringe that has lost its mind, and it resembles Hitler in the bunker in the last days of World War II. And I think they're going to come to that end. There is absolutely no hope of the Ukrainians busting out, doing a counteroffensive. They don't have the men. Three-fourths of their army has been destroyed. If you listen to other experts in the military field, Scott Ritter, Phil Guaraldi, Mike Maloof, General McGregor, all of us have analyzed this, and Ukraine is gone. It's dead, and it is a floundering shadow of what the Western media tries to portray it as. Now, the other thing is Russia is newly invigorated and quite infuriated as a result of these latest episodes where they've murdered a 29-year-old daughter of Alexander Dugin in cold blood. And they have been, as you said wisely, shelling the nuclear power plant, one of the largest in Europe, in a suicidal attempt to trigger a nuclear catastrophe in the hopes that somehow they can blame Russia for that. And that's going to win the European continent and America to the side of Ukraine as they poison the air and the water and the land of large swaths of Europe with this nuclear tragedy that the Ukrainians are trying to trigger. So it really is a sign of crazy desperation.
Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett joining us from San Francisco. Moving on, Twitter's former security chief has accused a communications company of misleading users and U.S. regulators about gaps in its security. Peter Zatko, in a whistleblower complaint, has claimed that American firm underestimated the number of fake and spam accounts. Zatko underlined that user data are vulnerable to attacks. The whistleblower has alleged that the company's security problems are a threat to the country's national security. Twitter has denied the accusation, saying that Zatko was dismissed for poor performance. The testimony could affect the company's legal battle with Elon Musk over his buyout bid. Musk, the world's richest man, has recently dropped his plans to buy the platform over its security problems. A former Louisville detective has pleaded guilty of providing false information to obtain a search warrant for Breonna Taylor's home that led to a 2020 raid in which the black woman was fatally shot. Kelly Goodlett admitted to conspiring with another ex-detective to falsify the warrant and to making untrue statements to cover up the fake affidavit. Goodlett faces up to 5 years in prison, a fine of $250,000, and 3 years of supervised release. Goodlett and two other officers were facing federal charges for falsifying the warrant. This as a fourth was charged with using excessive force by opening fire during the raid. The killing of Taylor, along with the killings of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, among others, sparked outrage and galvanized protests that peaked in intensity in the summer of 2020. Elsewhere, Yemeni officials say world bodies, including the UN, lack integrity and transparency in their humanitarian work in the war-torn country where millions of people struggle each and every day to get themselves some food. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
في اليوم العالمي للعمل.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UK Foreign Office has been urged to intervene after a PhD student of Leeds University was jailed in Saudi Arabia for sharing Twitter posts critical of Riyadh. The tweets have earned Saudi national Salman al-Shahab 34 years. Robert Carter reports.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too. Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
The Iraq's judiciary said that it will resume work on Wednesday after Shia cleric Muqtada Assad called on his followers to withdraw from outside the judiciary's premises. Iraq's Supreme Judicial Council has suspended activities on Tuesday after Assad's supporters camped out near its building. They demanded that the judiciary dissolve parliament. Later in the day, Assad asked his supporters to withdraw, but the cleric urged the protesters to continue their sit-in outside parliament. Saad's followers, called Sadrists, have been there for weeks now. They're preventing the formation of a government by rival Shia parties nearly 10 months after Iraq's elections. Saad called for the dissolution of parliament and early elections after withdrawing his lawmakers from parliament in June. Meantime, Iraq's popular mobilization forces say they are ready to defend the government branches, particularly the judiciary. The forces have also asked the caretaker government to take up responsibility to protect the state bodies. Moving on to the deadly flash floods in Afghanistan, UNICEF says 8 kids were among the 20 people who lost their lives in the recent natural disaster in the country's central and eastern parts. UNICEF also warned that the child death toll could rise. Dozens of people have also been injured in the flooding. Heavy rain has destroyed thousands of homes and damaged agricultural land. Afghanistan has been reeling from natural disasters this year. In June, drought and a massive earthquake killed over 1,000 people. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Limelight. Debate about the search of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence has settled into well-worn grooves. Mr. Trump and many Republicans have denounced the act as illegitimate. Attorney General Merrick Garland is staying mostly mum, and Democrats are struggling to contain their enthusiasm. The article you're about to hear has been written by Damon Linker, a former columnist at The Week and writer of the newsletter Eyes on the Right. The article has been published in the New York Times opinion section and is titled, "There is no happy ending to America's Trump problem." Debate about the search of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence has settled into well-worn grooves. Mr. Trump and many Republicans have denounced the act as illegitimate. Attorney General Merrick Garland is staying mostly mum. And Democrats are struggling to contain their enthusiasm. Liberal excitement is understandable. Donald Trump faces potential legal jeopardy from the 6th of January investigation in Congress and the Mar-a-Lago search. They anticipate fulfilling a dream going back to the earliest days of the Trump administration, to see him frog march to jail before the country and the world. But this is a fantasy. There is no scenario following on from the present that culminates in a happy ending for anyone, even for the Democrats. Down one path is the prosecution of the former president. This would be a Democratic administration putting the previous occupant of the White House, the ostensible head of the Republican Party, and the current favorite to be the GOP presidential nominee in 2024, on trial. That would set an incredibly dangerous precedent. Imagine each time the presidency is handed from one party to the other, an investigation by the new administration's Justice Department leads towards the investigation and possible indictment of its predecessor. Some will say that Donald Trump nonetheless deserves it, and he does. If Merrick Garland does not press charges against him for the January 6th or the potential mishandling of classified government documents, Donald Trump will have learnt that becoming president has effectively immunized him from prosecution. That means the country would be facing a potential second term for Mr. Trump, in which he is convinced that he can do whatever he wants with complete impunity. That seems to point to the need to push forward with a case, despite the risk of turning it into a regular occurrence. As many of Donald Trump's detractors have argued, the rule of law demands it, and failing to fulfill that demand could end up being extremely dangerous. But we've been through a version of the turbulent Trump experience before. During the Trump years, the system passed this stress test. We have reason to think it would do so again, especially with reforms to the Electoral Count Act, likely to pass during the lame duck session following the upcoming midterm elections, if not before. Having to combat an emboldened Donald Trump or another bad actor would certainly be unnerving and risky. But the alternatives would be too. We caught a glimpse of those alternative risks as soon as the Mar-a-Lago raid was announced. Within hours, leading Republicans had issued inflammatory statements, and these statements would likely grow louder and more incendiary through any trial, both from Mr. Trump himself and from members of his party and its media rabble-rousers. Though, at a federal judge's order, a redacted version of the warrant affidavit may soon be released, so Donald Trump and the rest of his party would have to contend with the government's actual justification of the raid itself. If the matter culminates in an indictment and trial of Donald Trump, the Republican argument would be more of what we heard day in and day out throughout his administration. His defenders would claim that every person ostensibly committed to the dispassionate upholding of the rule of law is in fact motivated by rank partisanship and a drive to self-aggrandizement. This would be directed at the Attorney General, the FBI, the Justice Department, and other branches of the so-called deep state. The spectacle would be corrosive, in effect convincing most Republican voters that appeals to the rule of law are invariably a sham. But the nightmare wouldn't stop there. What if Donald Trump declares another run for the presidency, just as is indicated, and treats the trial as a circus, illustrating the power of the Washington swamp and the need to put Republicans back in charge to drain it? It will be a risible claim, but potentially a politically effective one. And he might well continue his campaign even if convicted, possibly running for president from a jail cell. It would be Donald Trump versus the system. He would be reviving an old American archetype, the folk hero outlaw who takes on and seeks to take down the powerful in the name of the people. We wouldn't even avoid potentially calamitous consequences if Donald Trump somehow ended up barred from running or his party opted for another candidate to be its nominee in 2024, say Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. How long do you think it would take for a freshly inaugurated President DeSantis to pardon a convicted and jailed Donald Trump? Hours? Minutes? And that move would probably be combined with a promise to investigate and indict Joe Biden for the various crimes that he allegedly committed in office. The instinct of Democrats is to angrily dismiss such concerns, but that doesn't mean these consequences wouldn't happen. Even if Merrick Garland's motives and methods are models of judiciousness and restraint, the act of an attorney general of one party seeking to indict and convict a former and possibly future president of the other party is the ringing of a bell that cannot be unrung. It is guaranteed to be undertaken again, regardless of whether present and future accusations are justified. As we've seen over and over again since Donald Trump won the presidency, our system of governance presumes a certain level of public spiritedness at the level of the presidency, in Congress, and in the electorate at large. When that is lacking, when an aspersive figure is elected, when he maintains strong popular support within his party, and when that party remains electorally viable, high-minded efforts to act as antibodies defending the body politic from the spread of infection can end up doing enduring harm to the patient. Think of all these times during the Trump presidency when well-meaning sources inside and outside of the administration ended up undermining their own credibility by hyping threats and overpromising evidence of wrongdoing and criminality. That's why it's imperative we set aside the Plan A of prosecuting Mr. Trump. In its place, we should embrace a Plan B that defers the dream of a post-presidential perp walk in favor of allowing the political process to run its course. If Donald Trump is the GOP nominee again in 2024, Democrats will have no choice but to defeat him yet again, hopefully by an even larger margin than they did last time. Mr. Trump himself and his most devoted supporters will be no more likely to accept that outcome than they were after the 2020 presidential election. The bigger the margin of his loss, the harder it will be for Donald Trump to avoid looking like a loser, which is the outcome he dreads more than anything, and one that would be most likely to loosen his grip on the Republican Party. There is, of course, one obvious risk. If Donald Trump runs again, he might win, but that's a risk we can't avoid, which is why we may well have found ourselves in a situation with no unambivalently good options.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
Part 1.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. On June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Ali Abdullah Saleh ruled Yemen for 3 decades. Before that, he was the president of North Yemen for many years. This is the museum he established to mark his own presidency after he resigned. His resignation did not mean that he wouldn't return to Yemen's political arena. Saleh had surrendered during the revolution in Yemen and delegated power to Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi and left the country for the U.S. under the pretext of medical treatment. On February 19, 2014, UN envoy Jamal Ben Omar announced that Saleh could take part in the upcoming elections in Yemen. At that time, Saleh was pursuing his own goals and got closer to the Houthis to make a unity with them. In terms of tribal divisions, the Houthis are Zaydis, just like him, and more importantly, they're considered Yemen's main power. If he sought a future in Yemen, he had to form an alliance with the Houthis. The coalition was eventually formed on August 10, 2016, between the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh. The coalition was aimed at putting up a resistance front against Saudi raids. Parts of the Yemeni army still took orders from Saleh. The Houthis needed his power for the war. Saleh, too, needed the Houthis' influence in order to regain power. As long as they could find a solution for the Saudi attacks, it was a win-win situation for both sides. But the answer the leader didn't trust Saleh that much. He had to choose either of the two. Mohammed bin Salman, an ambitious Saudi young man who had launched an invasion on Yemen with all of its force on the one hand, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, a Yemeni dictator who was ready to join him in the fight against Saudi Arabia for now. October 8, 2016, some horrifying news from Yemen left the world in shock. Saudi forces bombed a funeral ceremony. 155 people were killed and 525 people were wounded. The number of fatalities on that day was more than half of the fatalities during the first 2 months of Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Gradually, public opinion in the world sympathized with the Yemeni people. Images from Yemen were the most horrifying images in the world. However, Houthi revolutionaries were under immense pressure.
لم تكن شكوك السيد عبد الملك الحوثي خاطئة. سرعان ما توضح.
There was a good reason why Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, was so hesitant. Soon it came to light that Saleh was hand in glove with the Saudi-led coalition. The United Arab Emirates was supposed to play a secondary role in the war, a country behind Saudi Arabia. But UAE officials pursued their own aspirations. They know that Saudi Arabia is dreaming about becoming the regional leader and historically consider countries like the UAE as part of their own land. Saudi Arabia started a power game in Yemen, but the UAE was after business.
2006, when the war in Yemen hadn't broken out yet and Ali Abdullah Saleh was still Yemen's president, they signed a contract to construct a city named Al-Nur, or the City of Light. After the war broke out, Emiratis built prisons of their own. Some people were reportedly tortured in the prisons. However, it was always the UAE's humanitarian aid convoys in front of the cameras. The Emiratis had learned something that Saudi Arabia hasn't even started to think about. The UAE views the countries in the region the same way the colonial UK viewed regional countries. Saudi Arabia is after attacking, occupation, and capturing the region, just like a traditional government. But the UAE is after business. And it doesn't make any difference for it whether it was going to achieve this goal through prison and torture or humanitarian aid convoys. The important thing is to push things forward, especially since Yemen's energy resources, including its oil and gas, are still intact. For companies, the temptation is so big that they will even get involved in bloody games. From November 28, 2017, the streets in Sana'a were scenes of clashes between Saleh loyalists and the Houthis. On December 2nd, Saleh appeared on Yemen's state television and called on the people to wrest back the country's control from the Houthis. What had happened? Why did the alliance between Saleh and the Houthis end so quickly in a year? The Houthis answered the question 2 days later. On December 4th, 2017, Mohammed Abdul Salam, the Houthi spokesman, told Al Jazeera that Saleh had clandestine ties with Saudi Arabia and certain other Arab countries for 3 months. Saleh seemingly sided with the Ansarullah resistance, but he negotiated with enemy representatives behind the scenes and was ready to make a peace deal with them. For Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Saleh was a traitor. The street clashes by Saleh's supporters to occupy the Houthis' headquarters failed. It was strange that no domestic force could defeat the Houthis. And the big question was, if the Houthis were merely a tribal group with no relevance to the national will in Yemen, and if they didn't enjoy support from the Yemeni people, why was it so hard to defeat them? The easiest answer for bin Salman was to point the finger at Iran. Iranian officials never denied that they were supporting the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni people, even though the support is mostly spiritual. At the same time, Iranian officials are pessimistic about bin Salman's aspirations. Bin Salman doesn't have sufficient experience to lead a region, and his short record in Yemen doesn't promise a bright future. People in Yemen are in a very tough situation. On April 21, 2015, when Saudi Arabia announced that it would temporarily halt its military operation, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman welcomed the Saudi decision because if the military operation did continue, the famine and disease in Yemen would become more widespread. International media spread the news. Western parliaments hit out at their governments for selling arms to Saudi Arabia. After a short ceasefire, Saudi Arabia resumed its heavy airstrikes. While the international image of the Saudis has been tarnished because of its heavy bombardment of Yemen, the Emiratis were secretly pushing their own agenda. They trained 35,000 Yemeni forces in Aden and other areas. They also had a plan for this strategic island named Socotra. Yemeni military forces on the island are trained by the United Arab Emirates. With their petrodollars, the Emiratis had bought mercenaries from other parts of the world as well. 1,800 paid militants from Colombia, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, and 400 mercenaries from Eritrea. It also bought off the heads of the tribes. Its influence also caused Riyadh's anger. Muslim Brotherhood is one of the oldest Islamic political parties in Egypt. Later on, it attracted many supporters in other Arab countries. They want the return of Islam in the face of nationalist and communist elements. Such parties are called Brotherhood. In Yemen, there was a brotherhood party called Islah Party. Saudi Arabia supported it, but the UAE was against it. It was clear what they were going to fight over next. In Yemen's traditional society, half of the people aren't Zaydi Shias, they are Sunnis. Brotherhood supporters seek to find a bastion among the Sunnis. More extremist groups like Al-Qaeda also try to recruit forces within this social context. The majority of Sunnis in Yemen are not inclined towards radical groups like Al-Qaeda, so brotherhood parties like Islah have a bigger chance. After the chasm opened wider, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi deposed two of his officials who had ties with the UAE. It was obvious that the Saudis were behind it. The UAE-affiliated groups formed a transitional council and announced If Hadi does not resign, they'll topple his government within 7 days. The bloody infighting among anti-Houthi forces started, this time between UAE supporters, named the Southern Transitional Council, and Saudi supporters, namely Hadi and his forces. After Hadi's palace was besieged by the UAE-backed rebels, the clashes ended with mediation efforts, but it was clear that the Saudi project in Yemen was heavily defeated. The Emiratis had thrown down the gauntlet. They thought they could defeat the Houthis within 2 weeks, but now they were wasting $1.3 million every month for an endless war, and they had to flex their muscles to their partner, namely Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman had just realized that the differences within the coalition were serious. Forget about defeating the Houthis, large cracks had appeared within his coalition. During this period, Iran secretly provided Yemenis with food and medical supplies. Because Saudi Arabia had laid siege on Yemen, and the chances for food supplies, especially from Iran, are next to nothing. But food supply wasn't enough. If Yemenis couldn't defend themselves, the humanitarian situation in Yemen would further deteriorate. In an interview with a Chinese television network on October 1, 2019, General Mohammad Baqiri, a high-ranking Iranian military official, spoke of Iran's advisory assistance to Yemen. در مورد یمن خب راه‌های یمن کاملاً مسدود هست و امکان کمک به اونجا به شکل تجهیزات و تسلیحات وجود نداره لذا اینکه گفته میشه از جمهوری اسلامی ایران موشک حمل میشه به یمن دروغه و وقتی بسته کوچک دارو امکان حملش نیست چطور موشک‌های چند متری امکان حملش باشه اما کمک مستشاری و فکری ما به ارتش مردمی یمن صورت میدیم و ما در کنار مردم یمن خواهیم بود تا اینکه بتونن این تجاوز را از کشورشون دور کنن. Yemen has the second biggest army in the Arabian Peninsula after Saudi Arabia in terms of the number of forces. The Yemeni army dates back to World War I and the independence of North Yemen. It means it's older than any other army in the peninsula. But the problem of the Houthis isn't the number of forces. The war imposed by Saudi Arabia is unequal. The Saudis buy the latest U.S. warfare at exorbitant prices, but Yemen is a poor country. The solution was to somehow tip the balance to make it an equal war. It means Yemenis should be able to take advantage of being Saudi Arabia's neighbor and threaten Saudi interests by making indigenous missiles.
In the limelight.
This is a completely under the radar news story, one that was curiously absent from the headlines in all of the major newspapers this morning, wrote one expert after the latest US strike on Somalia. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Corporate Media Mostly Mom as US Strikes Kill at Least 20 in Somalia.
Here's the story. Monitors have recently drew attention to a series of U.S. airstrikes in Somalia in recent months, attacks that have received relatively little attention in the American corporate media, despite having reportedly killed more than 20 people. If you were unaware that we were bombing Somalia, don't feel bad. This is a completely under-the-radar news story, one that was curiously absent from the headlines in all of the major newspapers this morning, wrote Kelly Bikar Velahus, a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Recently, anti-war's Dave DeCamp reported that U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, launched its second strike on Somalia in a week. AFRICOM said its initial assessment found the attack, which occurred in Beledweyne and killed 13 fighters belonging to the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, and that no civilians were harmed. AFRICOM also said it killed 4 Al-Shabaab members in 3 separate airstrikes near Beledweyne on August 9th, 2 fighters in a joint U.S.-Somali operation near Labi Kas on July 17th, and 5 militants in a June 3rd bombing outside Beershani.